This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The year is 1993, where Mel Gibson makes his theatrical debut as director, with new writer Malcolm McRory, who adapts the story of the 1972 Isabel Holland novel of the same name, who tells the tale of young Chuck Norstad, played by Nick Stahl, who wants nothing more than to join a prestigious military academy like his late father, but he is wary of the school's lofty academic standards. With only a single summer in which to study for the entrance exam, Chuck finds an unlikely tutor in the form of Justin McLeod, played by Mel Gibson, a disfigured recluse who was once a teacher. McLeod agrees to teach Chuck, and the two form a deep friendship, until a town of rumors gets involved and Chuck learns of the story behind McLeod's terrible scars, and has to discover the distinction between friendship and social pressures of assumption that is completely out of his control as a child. This week on Back to the Balcony, we dive into 1993's The Man Without a Face.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
All right, so this is one of those movies of the 90s that really did stay with me as a real impact when it comes to the emotional element, especially as a young kid that really was about the same age as Norstad. This one is one of those movies where I did read the book, and it came after I watched this movie, and this is one of the rare movies, I'll say, that I preferred the movie adaptation more than the actual book, because what it does is really encourages the audience that we see in a rare form when it comes to adaptions to really have the audience critically think. And that's what I really respected about this movie. But as I became to my second rewatch, this movie really, to an extent, doesn't have the impact, because when it comes to the reality of today, the society is really different to an extent where we have technology creating these environments. And this is a movie that really... Go back. And this is a movie that really does hold true to how we act as a society and culture when it comes to rumors, and how the impact of assumption can really not form on adult minds, but the children that we tend to overlook. So is this a great movie now compared to in the 90s? To me, it's not, but this also is a huge reminder of how good, even with his first film, of a director Mel Gibson can be, given the delicate material that he really hovers over when it comes to the substance of these characters.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. I grew up with this movie. I saw it in the theater, and if it was on HBO or any of the cable channels, I'd watch it. And I think the reason why it speaks to me as a drama and why I found it so appealing to watch at that young age is because you do kind of, as a young man, envy the relationship he does have with the Mel Gibson character, because unlike the book, which I've read the book too, the book takes it in places that the movie was wise not to go, but it's still kind of like the central theme of the conflict between the Nick Stahl character and the Mel Gibson character. But like, I think any young man or any young boy will want to look up to someone that knows more, especially if they don't have a dad in the house. See, I did, and he taught me a lot of stuff, but also I had a lot of like dad-like figures in my life that would teach me magic tricks or filmmaking and things like podcasting, like I'm doing now. Like, I had a friend who did audio engineering and stuff like that. So I always had access to cool people that taught me a lot of cool shit. And I was so grateful to have those people in my life, because when you watch a movie like this or Karate Kid, where you see guys that don't have fathers and they find father figures or people that are going to fill that role of mentor, there's something that's really appealing about that. I like this movie a lot. I agree with you. It does not hold up as well as it used to. We kind of talked about this on my other show, where about like the bottleneck of writing yourself in a pop culture bubble, where a film like this doesn't really make sense for audiences today, because if this was a contemporary film, you could just Google the guy and know his backstory and they would probably never even connect. So the nostalgia part, the part where this is a period piece set in the 60s, where we don't have that kind of access to information, it is a small town full of gossip and rumors. That is what really kind of builds the world this movie takes place in.
Well, it's completely different because it's a coming-of-age story with extreme conflict. You have the family conflict. You have the multiple brothers and sisters, the half-sisters growing up in this family. You have the father figure that's damaged as well, and these two find each other. Then you have, of course, the overlaying arc of the story and the twist. I don't know if it's a twist, but of the darkness of what Mel Gibson's character has been accused from. So this movie has multiple directions, and there is a scene with Margaret Witten that we can almost feel all these conflicts come to an arc where she takes her frustration out on her oldest daughter. So to me, this is a complex movie. And when I said this is how good not only our new writer Malcolm McMurray was when writing all these conflicts, but the direction of how it's executed by Gibson, it is almost to an extent flawless on how all this comes together. And as a first film, we don't see that from directors, so really taking their time on really focusing on a lot of the emotional elements. These are up-close shots, especially what Gibson uses, that are extremely effective on building the tension of emotion. Not the tension just to throw in tension, but the tension of each individual character to see what direction they're going to go to. So this is not a rehash of a formula that we've seen, because there's complexity to these characters. So to the overall, just because it's a drama and it wants to really go on the emotion, doesn't make that just like everything else. It's what and how we get there. And that's what separates this movie, especially in 1993, apart from all the others, Sleepless in Seattle's and Scent of a Woman. We have a lot of these driven complexities that really make this special.
Well, it does something that those other two movies don't really do either, and that's really focus on the mental illness and instability of this young man. And it doesn't really touch on it too much, other than we know that he, you know, blacks out. He has these moments where he pauses. He's got a lot of self-doubt and this idea of where his mom had to create like a fake history for his dad because his dad suffered from mental illness too. I think that if this film was made these days, they'd really focus on that and play it heavy-handedly. And this movie doesn't. They give you just enough to know that your character that you're following throughout the movie, he's got a lot of issues. And so it's a flawed character that we are following, and he is being tutored by an equally flawed character. But they're smart enough in the writing and the directing where they don't make that the main focal point of the movie. One thing I can say about Mel Gibson is that as a director, he just makes it look so easy. Like, the film just flows. Like, he really shows that he knows how to make a story work and create a pace and a character development that we care about that never seems inconsistent. But also, you're dealing with people that are kind of working class fishermen. You know, it's a small town. It's not filled of wealthy people. The wealthiest person in town just might be Justin McLeod, played by Mel Gibson. So it creates a different dynamic that the other films that they talk about and compare it to don't, where we're talking about Ivy League prep schools, right? And all these rich kids. And yes, there are the poor kids in that movie too, in Scent of a Woman and in Dead Poets Society. But we are using that hierarchy of these privileged kids as one of the main focal points of why these kids are having problems with their life. And like, oh, the expectations of me, my dad's a senator, my dad's a mayor. This movie doesn't have to deal with that. it has to deal with loss. And that's, to me, more interesting than the comings and goings of these rich kids in other movies. My biggest issue, though, if I have to jump into it, is I don't really think that Mel Gibson should have played this character. He is so much better of a director in this film than he is a performer. I feel like he's really putting his energy into the filmmaking and leaving a little bit of the character on the table. And when I go back and I read the people that were considered and offered the position and eventually either turned it down or never responded, it makes me really wish we could have seen some of those. The big three were Alec Baldwin, Ray Liotta, Kurt Russell, and almost, there's my light, almost William Hurt. And every time I watch this movie now, I'm like, damn it, I would have loved to have seen William Hurt in this role. I'm not saying Gibson's bad. I'm just saying that I think the film could have been that much better if he just focused on the directing and not trying to perform.
I actually agree 100% because William Hurt would add almost a visual empathy to this character, because my biggest problem with Mel Gibson, and I'm not saying it's a bad performance because I think he does a decent job, but there is a little bit of lightheartedness that at times are needed in some of these scenes, and Gibson can come across as so damaged, and rightfully so in this manner, but at the same time, there are scenes that do require him to open up a little bit more. There's a scene where we first hear him laugh that's extremely effective. And that's the first time we actually see a human element to him that's not the stern character. And when he laughs, it is almost a relief, but at the same time, it feels like it should have been much, much more from this performance. It should have had something follow it. And I think that's what's really missing from the performance and the character per se. And again, if Gibson is directing it, this is where we should have realized that there should have been a little bit more of just a laugh to build, to kind of give the audience that relief. William Hurt would have added that. And even I think Jeff Bridges at one point was considered, and I think that would have even been really good. But again, I don't want it be lost in translation that Mel Gibson, it's not a bad performance, but it could have been a much better insertion to this cast.
And Nick Stahl, I mean, I've liked that guy in everything. And I remember seeing him in the theater on this film, like on the screen. I'm like, man, I can connect with this guy. It doesn't feel like a forced child performance, because you and I have both talked about how a bad child performance can ruin a great movie. We've seen it happen before, and this isn't that. In fact, I think he's so good that I often forget that he is a child. When those two share scenes, especially the ones of like hostility and anger, when Gibson is pushing his buttons to get a rise out of him, to get him motivated to do better on this exam, you are feeling like you're watching two adults speak to each other, you know? So I think that's very, very, I'm going to say it's lucky for the production to have such a good performance from that guy. But also, I think that Gibson just knew how to direct him really well. And we get that from the other characters too. Granted, the sisters and the mom are very cliche and stereotypical, but we also have to kind of push that narrative a little bit more because it helps us embrace the idea that this is a fatherless boy essentially being raised by three women and he just wants to get out. And I feel sometimes the film loses that, where he needs to get away from them and this is his answer. So he finds solace with the Justin McLeod character, which the town doesn't like because they have their own opinions and rumors and myths and lore, and there might be some truth to it, of what this guy's actual past is, why his face is the way it is, and the dark secret that he's been hiding while he's been living in this mansion out in the middle of nowhere. So I can see where some people don't want to get on board with that part of the story, but it really is crucial because it's like the old Yeller moment where we know it's coming. We know that there's going to happen, something's going to happen where they're going to pull these two apart, and we don't want it to, but that's part of the drama, that's part of the story.
We see it coming, but we don't know how, right. And I think that's one of the smartest pieces of this movie. And when it comes to Nick Stahl, to me, this one is his best movie, because as he grows in his career, I can't stand that guy. He lost me from Terminator 3. But when we have him in this one, there's the innocence, there's that aggression to them, and rightfully so. We have a bias to it. We have a foundation to that. It explains it. We just did Mermaids, and we almost get some of the same character traits out of Rebellion from this boy on why he feels this way. This is a little bit more to the extreme. And this is where I really think it is smart, is to take the 60s and have this unique family. It is the perfect time frame to give somebody different, where it doesn't add a very specific relatability. So we can be into this situation almost unfamiliar and where it's going to go. I mean, we have a mom with two half sisters, with a father that we don't know the huge history, he doesn't know, and then this mystery man. So this one, I think when it comes to being a crowd pleaser, it knows exactly where it wants to go, and Gibson takes it to a new level on how he's going to shoot it. The most brilliant shot, I think, of really adding to this mystery of the McLeod character is, again, I'm going to go back to the direction. We take this huge, beautiful house, and we have these wide out shots of seclusion, but redemption of this man. That, how does he afford it? How is he living his life? So it's a good balance of visuals to really tell a story of curiosity to how McLeod lives his life, just based on the angles and the shots that Gibson puts into this. And you can tell he spends some time on this, because we get probably about 10 shots, I think I've counted, of just the house being focused on when we get to a pivotal emotional moment of trying to define this character before we actually get an interaction with him. And that's what I really appreciated about it. It uses the visuals and the magic of the camera to really paint a picture of what we're about to see, but we don't know how it's going to be perceived.
I think the appreciation of Mel Gibson's performance and the bravery it took to do this has to come into the conversation as well, because at least for American audiences, people kind of knew him as an action star, right? For American audiences, most were introduced to him as Mad Max and then the Lethal Weapon films, right? He had a few in between, but that's mostly what people knew him for. Now, his earliest work, pre-Road Warrior, in films like Tim and The Year of Living Dangerously, right? These are dramas, so he did have dramatic chops that a lot of people did not recognize until this film came out. So you've got Lethal Weapon 3 and then this film coming out back-to-back, really kind of showing this guy is ready to do his dramatic chops. Yeah, he did Hamlet, which was really, really good, but he didn't direct that. But also, anyone can take a Shakespearean film and throw it into their mix of stuff. And, you know, I think Shakespeare is kind of a blessing and a curse, because I don't think there's mediocre Shakespeare productions. They're either really, really good or they're really, really bad. He had Franco Zeffirelli directing me in that one, so chances are it's going to be pretty good. But bringing in this kind of character where audiences were not ready to see him in this kind of role. I remember back when this film came out, that was a major point of contention, was that Mel Gibson cut all of his hair off and now he's got this weird face. Do I want to see him in this role? So there was already stigma there. And I'm not saying that I'm on that same train, but my train of thought of like, well, he shouldn't have been the main guy, definitely comes into play. However, just a couple years later, Braveheart comes out and completely washes all of that away.
I think it was a blessing in the summer of 93, because this one, and I think I've told you before, I think 93 was one of the best nostalgic summers of movies, in my opinion. But not only did he start with the dramatics, where he could have easily gone in and done an action, obviously, he's experienced in that. He's experienced in a lot of, he could have been experienced in a lot of independent films that came out, but he took a drama and set it for a 1993 summer release against Jurassic Park, Free Willy, Hocus Pocus, Son-in-Law, Coneheads, all these fantastic movies. So he was David and Goliath when it comes to this small picture going up against a lot of these summer blockbusters. And when you take the topic of what it tries to cover, it's a real gamble. So kudos to the studio for it, for allowing it during the summer. First of all, we wouldn't see that now. But there is a lot of risk taking to this movie when it comes to subject matter, time of release, and a new director in the summer of 93. So, and I think it's underrated when it comes to the year it was released, because it only did like 24 million at the box office compared to everything else. That one was kind of under the radar, and it only lasted probably 18 weeks in the theater compared to everything else that averaged over 25 weeks. So to me, I think this one really was a silent hit going into kind of what you said, when it's on cable, when it's on video, that's when people really did see it. And it kind of just went away from memories as we go into the 2000s, as we get into people not wanting to talk about the subject matter, because it can be a little damaging. It can be a little hard to take in as society goes into a lot of these topics of it. So I think it is really worth a watch, given just the how it's handled and how all the conflicts are handled. I think it's done very brilliantly.
You know, and I feel like he does try to channel like Richard Mulligan movies, like To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think it might have been the same year, the year before, that he did Man on the Moon, where there is that like nostalgia, but also the dangerous element to it, where youth is almost ignored until there's a reason to pay attention to what's actually going on. So it really does speak volumes that this mother has three kids from three different dads, and she's a serial relationship jumper, right? And they play that up very, very well, even towards the end, where it's like you're seeing her with a different guy each and every time. And she's dating like army dudes and then crazy like liberal hippies too. It really does build the idea of the disorganization of the household, how you have these three different people in this house with different personalities, with different dads. It's the little drama that could amongst this giant of blockbusters. And it gave us variety. It was like a palate cleanser. And that year, especially when you had all those different options, at least have that kind of sentimental movie there that would tug at the heartstrings, but also make you think, yeah, we don't get a lot of those anymore. In fact, the movies I've been seeing lately that would try and be the contemporary version of this, they can't do it unless they take those taboo subjects and put them right at the forefront of the movie. And this one didn't have to do that.
It doesn't take shortcuts. It doesn't take cheap shots. That's what makes it special. And we're going to get into it, but it kind of does upset me that our critics that are notorious for seeing blockbuster after blockbuster and getting tiresome of it, that they don't appreciate what this movie's intent is. And we get a lot of these conflicts in here that really should be more appreciated. But I think there's so much going on at a first time viewing that it's hard to grasp what the intent of our writer and Mel Gibson are trying to do with how they're portraying everything on screen. It's almost like you throw this movie into a loud crowd and you're expected to listen with all these noises in the background, and you really can't. You have to have all in focus on it. And that's part of the danger of releasing a movie during the summer, is what is this movie's intent to a movie critic? What is this movie's intent? What audience is it trying to reach? And this is where I think it gets really misconstrued, where it should have come in beginning or end of the year, where it kind of almost mimics a lot of these movies coming out, because our attention is already snapped to what we're looking for. And I think that's what really kind of put this critically underwater, is it's lost in a sea of loud noises.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the idea that this movie has a particular kind of audience, and to release it in a time of the year where audiences want escapism, I think is one of the things that kind of hindered this movie's success, at least box office wise and maybe critically of when it came out. But like I said, it is one of those movies that just kind of lived on cable or on VHS. I'm not even sure if anyone talks about it now. Mel Gibson's kind of like a trigger word for some these days. So it'd be very, very understandable if contemporary audiences did not have the desire to go back and revisit this film because of what Mel Gibson means to some people in the modern day community. But for back then, man, I thought this was a very special film. Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with a perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself.
Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. So let's hear what our critics have to say about this one. This was Gene's to bring to the show.
First film is The Man Without a Face, Mel Gibson's second attempt following his Hamlet of 2 years ago to reclaim his position as a serious dramatic actor and not be regarded as just a hunk. It's a decent film, but just not very original. Gibson plays a burn victim helping tutor a kid who bears his own scars on the inside. The boy comes from a troubled home and wants to escape it all by entering a military academy. He needs a tutor to help him with the entrance exam and finds one in Gibson, who has become a recluse after being burned in a car crash.
So just kind of the idea of where we're at in 1993, Gene totally solidifies it there, where Mel Gibson's status in the industry was the hunky action star. That's who he was, right? Hamlet kind of changed that for some, but Hamlet wasn't a very wide release. It was a limited release film. It did pretty good on video. I saw it in my drama class. Like, that's how I first saw it. Other than that, I feel like Mel Gibson's Hamlet in the early 90s, for the most part, was looked on with some kind of tongue-in-cheek humor, right? That's what people were really trying to infer, is that we don't want Mel Gibson to play a serious character. And even at the beginning of this critique, as he's just introducing the movie, you can kind of tell that Gene is in that same mindset, where it's like, okay, what are you going to do, Mel Gibson? We've been watching you be this hunky action star for like the last 7-8 years. You did your little Hamlet thing. Are you sure you want to take the dramatic route? Are you big enough to be a dramatic actor and a director? You can hear it in the vocal inflections as he's describing it, and it pisses me off.
Well, what really pisses me off is not just Gene, but when most critics do this, is they give a little hook line like that to lead into a review, but then they don't go into the big question that we always bring up of why. Or
why?
How? What's the contradiction to this hunky context? Is he good? Is it good direction? What is the follow-up? And he doesn't really give that. He sticks to a stereotypical description to stereotype Mel Gibson as an expectation of going into his review. So to me, that drives me nuts holistically. And Gene is notorious for that, because he really just is famous for those hooks, but no context afterwards of telling us the exact reason of why.
It turns out there's more to Gibson's story than that, and that provides another, of course, as the boy is required to be strong for Mel Gibson's character, as The Man Without a Face combines familiar elements from movies like Mask and Dead Poets Society and Son of a Woman, all films I like better than this one. After a shaky start to the picture, Gibson does direct the film in a satisfactory manner. I guess my big objection to the film is it didn't feel fresh in any way. He's a victim, the kid's a victim, together they'll triumph. I thought Son of a Woman's similar script was a new take on a familiar subject. This one is not.
So, I mean, we're going to let Roger speak mostly for that, because he has a contradictory opinion to that. I'm a little bit in the same boat with him, where maybe it felt too similar at that time, because this style of film was very popular back in the 80s and early 90s. He's totally right. We had Dead Poets Society. We had Son of a Woman leading right into this. Just a couple years earlier, we had Mask. I'm not saying Mask is anything close to this, but it's that heartstring movie. I always laugh, like I tell people, James L. Brooks used to make movies like this in the 80s. Those heartstring tugging comedies that had a lot of tragedy. And then he just went full comedy later on in the 90s. But this was the kind of movie. Even Ron Howard's Parenthood does that as well, where it's a comedy, but there's some real tragic, heartstring, dramatic moments too, where, like I said, we don't get movies like that anymore, at least in the PG-13 realm. Movies now that try and cover those same topics are really built into like the ideas that this is what really goes on behind closed doors. They're hard R movies. There's lots of language. There's lots of taboo. There's lots of sexuality, but they're trying to tell the same stories. They're just not done in the accessible ways that they did during this decade. So I get why he says that. It's just easy for me to like immediately try and dismiss that comment, because my mind's not there right now. But I do look back and I'm like, yes, this was a very common genre and in a sense kind of a common story back then. But does that make it any less good of a movie? I don't think so.
Well, it's common, yes, but I would take it a little bit more deeper. I would say it's common to really go after the emotional element. And yes, you can tie that into being a drama, which most dramas try to go for that emotion. But here is where I disagree is with Gene, is this isn't you take two damaged people and they end up triumph. Nobody here triumphs. Nobody wins.
No.
So
no one wins.
That could have been the same formula we got from any other drama that goes for the emotional heartstrings of the 90s, is there's a positive resolve. And yes, we get a little nugget at the end, but at the same time, it doesn't paint the picture for us. It's still a little subtle interpretation of what allows the viewers to take away from it, even though it kind of directs it in a positive outlook. But nobody wins in this. And what I really did appreciate about this compared to, say, Dead Poets Society, and you even touched on it earlier, is we don't have this privileged kid. We don't, obviously he has the brains, and what we've seen from movie time and time again, the privileged kid that wants to go to an academy has the money. He has the resources to do this. This is a kid that has to do it based on his own intelligence and really do it based on his wants of getting out of trauma. So at a surface level, if you look at just taking it away from the emotional level, I get it. You can take that away. But again, like we talked about earlier, there's an emotional element if you look below that. And we take away a lot of the elements here, especially in the last act, that it is very dark. And we are almost anticipating a courtroom scene. We're almost anticipating this big arc of solve, and we don't get it. We get a depressing ending that tries to be happy. And in a way, it can be, but it's based on the viewer's interpretation. And that's what makes it so special, is it doesn't tie all the bows. It allows the viewer to take that interpretation away. So I completely disagree with Gene on that comment.
Yeah. I mean, what it almost does is it almost does like a Harry and the Hendersons thing, where it's like Mel Gibson wants to be there for this kid, but he can't be. And it's not just because of the legal ramifications of it. That's just part of the story. Mel Gibson understands that this kid is turning him into a father figure, and he can't be a father figure. He has to be the tutor. He has to be the one to teach him the lesson that you can't rely on me to rescue you from your family. You have to do it yourself. And in Dead Poets Society and Scent of a Woman, we don't get that. We get the teacher to do it for them. We get Al Pacino to do it for him and stand up for him. That's the difference. And Roger actually brings that point to the table.
No, Gene, I thought it was a good deal more original than you give it credit for, because it doesn't simply deal with this obviously familiar material in a predictable way. The thing that I really liked about the film is that the people in it are so intelligent. They think smart. They talk smart. They don't do obviously dumb things as they would in a different kind of film. And in particular, the kid, the young Stahl boy, is a very good actor, a very natural actor in terms of standing up to this unfamiliar man and dealing with it.
Well, I guess I didn't find any surprise in the story. There was only one speech that I liked where he challenges the kid to think for himself and come to his own conclusion.
Well, that was a big surprise. You can tell me, as easily as I can tell you, how that scene would have been handled in a lesser film. And there would have been some kind, there even probably would have been some dumb courtroom scene at the end of this film. I think it's really great that Gibson, as a director and as his character, says, you've got to figure this out for yourself.
That's the one interesting element in the film. The rest of it, Roger, is really formulaic. All those pictures that I named, particularly Scent of a Woman, it's the same story as Scent of a Woman. Even you would admit that's handled a lot better.
If you think Scent of a Woman and Dead Poets Society are not formula pictures, I've got
these stories. They had many more fresh scenes other than this one that I just named.
I love it that Roger pulls that out. But yeah, he's 100% right, where you can't compare a formulaic setting to a film by using other formulaic movies as the examples that you're like trying to put it up against. It doesn't work. It totally dissolves your argument. All you're doing is saying that, yes, Hollywood needs to be more original and start creating more original movies, but this one does it better, so don't hold it up towards them. Does it have the prestige? Does it have the Oscars? Did it have all of the great stuff that people quote, because people quote Scent of a Woman all the time. People quote Dead Poets Society all the time. Nobody quotes Man Without a Face. I think that's fine. It makes it the dark horse of this conversation that people can go back and discover it and recognize how good it actually is. But this is the thing that it's not trying to be. It's not trying to be a bravado, sentimental, heartstring tugging film like those ones are. There is no inspirational speech. Get up on your desks, you know, seize the day. There's none of that shit in this movie. This movie is all about the reality of what happens when friendships have to crumble and when you have to start growing up earlier and younger than you want to. That is what makes this movie so different and unique from those others. I don't think they should have compared them at all.
No, and Son of the Women, I'm not going to say it's a bad movie. It is a good movie. But at the same time, just because it has memorable scenes, memorable quotes, and you can quote it, it has that entertainment value to it that really keeps you engaged along with great performances. But it's at a foundation of the same concept of trying to be dramatic in a different way. It's okay right. for two movies that have the same foundation of the same intent. But again, at the end of the day, it is the intent and how it gets there. These two are completely on different aspects of how the journey plays off. And we do have that scene where we have Mel Gibson ask and challenge this youngster. It was almost a lesson, his final lesson to adulthood of what do you think? The only time in this movie, somebody asks the child what he thinks and gives an opinion. That is a powerful scene. And I think it is underplayed. They call out that scene, but they don't give it enough credit because this is the forte. This is what the movie led up to, not the last 5 minutes of the movie, but this one scene to really have these two characters really solidify what it means to be friends and what makes a solid adult figure, father figure in relationship to a young child. So, and it's done so in a beautiful way where it still makes us think if we were judging these two in a negative way, it almost made us feel guilty because we don't know which way we're going to go. And I think they don't give that scene enough credit because that is the point of this movie if they didn't grasp it. So they, with the exception of Roger, he gets it, but Gene is still, he can't get past that surface level of the genre. It is okay, Gene.
Well, and I think the thing that bugs me the most about his opinion on this movie is that we see characters in this movie that we don't really follow throughout the whole film, but what we recognize is that they are literally just coasting through life. When you think about Nick Stahl's struggles, how he can't pass this exam and how he has to do all these studies and finds a tutor, well, at the same time, he is learning, just as Roger said, the intelligence. He is learning, and we realize that he actually knows more than the adults that he's sharing the scenes with. You know, so like the Richard Mazur character, I think, is a great thing because he's like this college professor. He's super liberal, but he doesn't know half of the things that Nick Stahl's learning in his studies. His sister's a moron. Her boyfriend's a moron. And his mom's a moron, right? And these are the people that are making the decisions of what his life should be. When we really learn this kid who thinks that he's an idiot is actually way more intelligent than these people are. And the little sister, Gabby Hoffman, she's just fun in anything. And she's kind of like the only real support he has in the family. But at the same time, she's got her own survival instincts, too, because she's not a full sibling with him or the older sister. She's got to watch her back as well. So I really did appreciate the fact that Roger called out the fact that these people are so intelligent because the way the movie's portrayed, you don't recognize that at first because it's just like, oh, you dumb kid, you didn't pass your exam. But then through the rest of the movie, you realize how unintelligent the adults in the film are. Even Jeffrey Lewis is the sheriff who's really just going off of personal bias and not fact, not logistic reasons of law enforcement and investigation. It's all opinion. And like Gibson says in the movies, it's like, okay, so they're not using their critical thinking. They're going strictly off their biases and their opinions. Nordstat, what do you think? Do you really think that? It's an amazing, poignant moment that I think is so genuine and real, and it's not overly dramatized like the movies that Gene is saying are better than it.
Well, even look at the boyfriend, the liberal Harvard professor, there is a moment that, yeah. And again, it goes back to how good Mel Gibson is on pivotal shots, of where everybody's fighting in the kitchen after a marriage announcement where this guy doesn't have any common sense, and he sees a natural family fighting, and he gets a close-up shot on the, oh, shit, what did I just get myself into? This is almost a symbolic message to people can be book smart, but at the same time, common sense goes out the door the more you get educated, right? And this is where the entire family just really shows that example. We get so caught up in society. We get so caught up in the daily life, our own egos, and we forget that a child can be just as smart as an adult, if not smarter. And I loved that fact of this movie, that they made that a pivotal trait of Charles in an overlaying and well-executed manner.
Well, and the fact that in his seclusion, Justin McLeod has become more in tune with himself and the people around him, because he's now being able to look at the world as an observer and not as a participant. And again, that's something that is just in the subtext of the movie. It is not out there for you to pick up on first glance. It's in the dialogue. It's in those long establishing shots that you're talking about, where when we see the master shots of him, they're from far away because he's the guy in the mountain watching all the clowns around him, right? And he brings that kind of knowledge and insight into tutoring this kid, not just to pass the exam. And I think that's the part that really, really people miss the boat on this conversation.
Well, it goes off of a lot of, again, with Gibson's direction and just the concept. It's the Hunchback formula, where we really do have the growth of a character in seclusion, being told by society that he's no good, being told that he's hideous, and he starts to believe that, and he needs redemption just as well as Charles does. He needs redemption of becoming an adult, validation, I should say, that he is good enough, and both of these characters want to be good. They want to do good. And that's what these two characters really add. It almost adds on to almost a sequel-esque of The Hunchback, so which I really did appreciate about it.
No, it's not formulaic at all. I don't care what Gene Siskel says. So when it comes down to it, I think that this movie sadly is kind of lost to time because people don't talk about it. It's not really discussed in Mel Gibson's finer accomplishments. Maybe Braveheart was just too big. It got all the Oscars, right? And then, hey, after like the mid-2000s, it's hard to talk about anything else that Mel Gibson did except for the famous incident. So, you know, me being like the exposure guy for my other show, it's like, this is something that it's available online. It's on Tubi. Like, it's something that is accessible. It's not a hard-to-find film, but I think it is one that's definitely taken a step back in the pantheon of Mel Gibson movies, because at the time it wasn't a hot ticket because he wasn't being what people wanted Mel Gibson to be. So go back and watch and see what he did as a director, as an actor, that was against the norm for his particular talents of that day and age.
100%. And even your views on Mel Gibson now, it doesn't really matter. It's art. It's watch it. It's well-deserving just what in the messaging by itself.
Agreed. So, yeah, Gene missed the boat on this one, but I'm not going to say that it was an entirely lazy critique like his other ones have been. I feel like this movie just didn't hit the buttons that normally get him going, but he didn't hate it. Sometimes I wonder if he knows if it's a movie that Roger likes and he just wants to be contradictory, and that's what it kind of feels like. That's what it feels like to me, at least. So not an absolutely terrible review, but it's definitely not constructive at all. And it doesn't give us the why that we always look forward to. So I'm going to put this right in the middle of the road and call it a C.
I think that's fair. And when it comes to Ebert, he hits it, and I wish he had control of this review. He did kind of take over, but he saw a lot more of what we're talking about right now. And his written review goes a little bit more in depth. But at the same time, I think there is only so much time between a 1,000-word written review and the 2-3 minutes that we get with this for him to express it. And I think he fully loaded what he could in the time frame that he did in defense to what Gene said. He turned a generic review and turned it into something with substance, for the audience to go out and look for when they watch this movie, which I did appreciate. So I think when it comes to Ebert, I think it's a solid 3 stars when it comes to giving us enough to what we really want in a drama and what we need to look for when it comes to this movie.
And not falling for the bait that this is just a clone of the other motivational movies of that era, like Dead Poets Society or Scent of a Woman. And before we finish the conversation, it's like I really have to kind of go back to my point again, where I just feel like movies like this don't exist anymore, because the hot topic of this movie, which we've kind of skirted around in our conversation, is that the town considers Justin McLeod to be a pedophile. They think that he was having an inappropriate relationship with a boy a decade earlier that resulted in a car crash. The boy died and his face got disfigured. That is the subtext of that character. But I feel if the movie was made today, that would be the forefront. That would be the drawing point of, we're going to have this kind of taboo subject matter and we're going to bring you in for that. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying that we live in a society now where it's like the hot button topic has to be the main focal point of your movie. It can't just be in the subtext anymore. So therefore, I feel like we are losing films like this, where you could have something like that, true or not, for the character, be as part of the subtext to play a bigger part in the story and the character development. These days, I feel like we have to be so artistically disruptive, right? We have to kind of shock people with the subject and content matter of our movie to get the attention, to get them in there, where this movie doesn't do that. It has nothing to do with the marketing. It has nothing to do with the poster. It's not even in the description on the back of the VHS. It's in the subtext of the movie, and we just don't have the nuance anymore to just let it be that way. We have to push those hot button topics, or else people aren't going to come to the movie. It's a weird, weird transition that we made over the last 20 years.
It really is, because you're absolutely right. If they made a movie like this, it would be right to the point. It would be, this is what this character's actions are. This is the result. And we're going to focus on the thing that really brought people into theaters, which is the topic of a pedophile. And again, if right. The story is told right, there's nothing wrong with that. But again, and we've had this discussion over and over again of not holding our hands. And that's what's really missing from storytelling. And not only that, but it's missing from movies to really reflect on society today, to really leave the opinion up to the audience, especially with subject matter like this, where it is a kind of a icky topic. It's an awkward topic to really conversate about that. And I really do get that. It's uncomfortable and it's damaging to a lot of people to really have that engagement into some of these topics. But that's the beauty of cinema, is one, we get emotional and sometimes it opens up our demons and sometimes it can really open up a conversation. And especially with this movie, The Man Without a Face, this is one that really leaves interpretation up to the audience to really encourage that dialogue, instead of just saying, this is the way you think, this is the way you should portray this character, and that's it. So there's a difference between damaging with the art versus leaving it up and opening up the dialogue with just the foundation built upon the intent.
And you also open yourself up more for a wider audience, 100%. Right? If you can make your story more accessible, you can still get all the points that you're trying to display in your film, but you can give it to a wider audience. Like, you could watch this movie in school. You know, it's PG-13, but there's nothing violent about it. There's not a lot of harsh words. I think there might be an F-bomb in there, but whatever. It's accessible, right? And I feel that so many filmmakers and writers and producers are getting frustrated that their films aren't finding wider audiences. And my opinion is because you're closing the gap to those audiences yourself. You know, you're making progressive films, and God bless you for doing it, but you're doing it in a manner that you are not allowing the John Q public that just wants to be entertained into your movie. Instead, you're challenging them. And there's just people out there that don't want to be challenged. There's people that just want to put the movie in, watch it, and then go to bed. Like, that is an audience that I think a lot of filmmakers and studios these days are dismissing. And I think that we would see a whole turnaround in the industry right now if we at least gave some filmmakers the chance to make accessible stories again. Not everything has to be controversial. Not everything has to be a hot button topic. Just make a goddamn good story and let people watch it.
This is probably one of the better examples of small movies that end to do good. You have Mel Gibson that demonstrated what a great director, and that led to Braveheart and Passion of the Christ and Apocalypto, whatever it may be. But there is a lot of great small movies that now, if these are pushed, they're going straight to streaming. They're, even though they're available to everybody, unless you get it word of mouth and it's really heavily advertised, it's not going to be seen. So this is one of those movies that really does show the example of small movies can lead to something big. And I love this when I talk about it to give that example, because we're not going to see any more movies like this for a long time, because when they're released to theaters, nobody's seeing it. When they're released to streaming, they get lost in translation, so which is an absolute shame.
Yeah, so definitely seek this movie out. So for next week, we are on my pick. I just barely looked at the list, and I totally forgot that I put it on the list, but I'm actually kind of excited because we've been kind of serious lately, what with Angel and Man Without a Face. So we're going to bring us back to the light. I brought to the table Lewis Teague's sequel to Romancing the Stone, and that is Jewel of the Nile, starring Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner, and we'll see what we feel about this movie. Are you excited for this one,
Justin? It's an 80s staple. I cannot wait.
I mean, we've done 80 staple sequels before, and of course the conversation's going to come up. Is the sequel better than the original? We've already had a couple on the show. I guess we'll find out. So everyone, thank you for watching, listening. Please like, review, rate, subscribe, 5 stars, all that good stuff to Back of the Balcony. Make sure you hit me up on my other show, the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast. You can find all of my links on thecultworthy.com. You can find Justin Henson and his show, The Movie Wire, at
themoviewire.com.
And like we say every episode, please suggest a movie for us to watch. As long as Siskel and Ebert reviewed it, we want you to send the recommendations in. Got a few so far, so let's keep them coming, because I'd love to see a lot of that in year two. I mean, we're almost to a year, bro. We're September right now. We're recording. This will come out in October, but January 1 will be a year, and we got a whole kind of reset of what we want to do. So we want to see a lot more suggested movies on that list.
I can't wait to finish out this year, especially going into Christmas time and what the next year is going to bring and what others are going to bring to us when it comes to movies. So I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. I'm like really hoping that we're not like shooting our load too early with so many great holiday films. And then next holiday, we're going to be like, shit, we used all the good ones.
Bring out Rudolph. So here we go.
Oh, shit. It might be a season of just bad holiday movies, but anyway, we got a year to decide that. It's been great talking to you. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.